Judge Posner was so overwhelmed by the last case that he decided to leave.
He left. Judge Williams will be with us by speakerphone. Are you there, Judge Williams?
I am here, Judge Kaney. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're ready for the second case this morning, which is Thompson versus Memorial Hospital in Jackson County.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Tim Eaton, and I represent Memorial Hospital of Carbondale. Your Honors, let me state up front that I realize my burden with respect to a jury verdict is that I must show that the evidence was insufficient to show intentional discrimination upon race by the decision maker in this case, and that no rational jury could have found that there was discrimination in the case. But before I get to some of the fact-specific arguments, I would like to address two issues which are legal issues. And I believe that based upon this record, giving the plaintiff all permissible inferences, that he has not shown a material adverse employment action. And the reason I say that is, as a matter of law, I believe that being put on a supervised probation is not something that the case law is recognized as a material adverse employment action. And as a matter of fact, I couldn't find anything directly on point with respect to a medical setting where there's been supervised probation. But this court in the Nichols versus Southern Illinois University at Eversville case, which dealt with paid administrative leave, found that that was not a material adverse employment action. And in that case, like in this case, the plaintiff was given a 3-month paid administrative leave while they did certain psychological tests to determine whether or not this officer for the university was capable of coming back. They concluded he was. He did come back, and the court found that there was no material adverse employment action. I believe in this case, a first impression, as far as I'm aware, where you're dealing in a medical setting, that it's very important that the medical field have the ability to put someone on a supervised probation where there's a concern about the safety of how they're treating patients. And I believe the facts show here that there was a sincere concern by Dr. Doolittle, who was the medical director of this emergency medical system, that the plaintiff was presenting a situation where it may be unsafe for him to continue without some supervision for a limited period of time. He received the same pay, he received the same benefits, and with respect to whether or not this was a condition of employment that was altered that would meet the test for an adverse material employment action, we would argue that it was not, for several reasons. I know this court has dealt with the issue in Smart versus Ball State as to whether or not testing of an individual or requiring them to take tests is not an adverse material employment action without more. As a matter of fact, this court in Whitaker versus Northern Illinois University said that in some settings where a person is given a severe criticism or some sort of feedback, that that can actually be constructive so that they could improve.
Well, we know that under the McDonnell-Douglas test, you definitely have to show there was a materially adverse employment action. But here, we're dealing with a situation after trial. So isn't the only question we have to deal with whether or not there was enough evidence of discrimination rather than going back to that burden to McDonnell-Douglas?
Your Honor, I believe McDonnell-Douglas does fall away. You're absolutely correct when there's a jury verdict and the case has gone to jury. But there still has to be proof, even following a jury action, that the plaintiff has suffered some material adverse employment action as a matter of law. Even where there may be intentional discrimination, if they haven't been materially adversely affected, then there is no cause of action. And I would argue here that that has not been shown. And I understand with respect to the other elements, with respect to disparate treatment, with respect to whether he was performing his job satisfactorily, that those factors fall away and then the focus becomes on intentional discrimination. A second point which I would like to raise also as a matter of law is whether or not there was a sufficient contract here under 1981. Memorial Hospital filed a motion to dismiss at the beginning of this case saying that this plaintiff was not an employee of the emergency medical system. And Judge Foreman, in denying that, said to the plaintiff, you have to prove this. You have to prove that you were an employee. And as a matter of fact, although the emergency medical system via Dr. Doolittle may have controlled the medical management of incidents that occurred, they did not hire him. They could not fire him. They could not change his shift. They did not set his shift. They did not control his hours. This was all done by Jackson County Ambulance Service.
Can you weigh that argument?
No, Your Honor. This was raised in our motion for summary judgment, and this court held in Labor's Pension Fund that where you have, if it's not mentioned in the 50A motion, that if the plaintiff is aware of what the issue is, and clearly they were with the motion to dismiss and also the motion for summary judgment, that the court's not going to take a mechanistic approach as to whether or not it was in the 58.
The language in paragraph C on page 17 of your memorandum in support says, while a dispute may exist as to whether Thompson had a contract and with whom the contract was made, this dispute is not material for the purposes of summary judgment.
Your Honor, I agree that, well, with respect to whether or not...
And your, as a matter of fact, your motion for judgment as a matter of law states, number one, the only issue for trial is whether the plaintiff was subjected to disparate treatment on the basis of his race when he was placed on probation.
Your Honor, I agree that that's what it says. Looking at the issue, though, it was raised clearly in the motion for summary judgment that put the plaintiff on notice that this contract issue was there. It was raised again in the motion to dismiss, and it was also raised in the motion for judgment as a matter of law under 50B. So I think clearly the plaintiff was on notice that they had to prove a contract between the plaintiff and the memorial system, and they did not. There's no other indicia of employment here, and I think as far as I've been able to tell, other than the plaintiff has responded with cases that dealt with the FELA, and I think one on a retaliatory discharge in a workers' compensation context, there's no cases that they point to in 1981 where the courts have held as a matter of law that this so-called dual employer argument would hold fast, and we don't believe it does because what you're dealing here was just simply control of medical management.
It seems to me that this case was defended on the basis that there was no disparate treatment.
Yes.
I think you make an interesting point about the adverse employment action, and I don't know that we'd want to have a situation where anybody in the workplace who gets put on probation for a short period of time has a lawsuit that they can bring, but was that ever advanced as a factual issue for a jury to decide in this case?
As to whether there was an adverse employment action?
Right.
Your Honor, I believe it was raised as a matter of law.
I understand.
Right.
So it wasn't, as a matter of fact, ever argued. And this case was defended on the basis that the plaintiff here wasn't treated any differently than anybody else. And certainly not treated any differently because of his race. That was the defense. The jury didn't buy it.
Well, in fact, I think the jury instruction said, was there intentional discrimination based upon, and as you correctly state, disparate treatment? And I would argue that plaintiff failed to show sufficient evidence to prove intentional discrimination. And as Judge Williams said earlier, I understand the McDonnell-Douglas test falls away when you're dealing with the jury verdict, but you can't get by the fact that the issue becomes intentional discrimination as to him being placed on probation.
Yeah, but you can defend a case, even though I agree that the McDonnell-Douglas prongs fall out of a case once we go to a jury, but you can argue as a matter of fact that someone did not have any penalty in the workplace. I mean, for instance, if a disgruntled employee was yelled at or something, you certainly wouldn't could argue that that isn't discrimination.
You can, but I think, Your Honor, at the end of the day, I believe it's the court's responsibility to determine, based upon all of the facts that were presented, and I understand because this is a jury case, you would have to give all reasonable inferences to the plaintiff and look on the plaintiff's facts as he presented. And my argument is that even giving the plaintiff all of the favorable inferences as to the facts, that as a matter of law, there was no adverse employment action here. Putting someone on supervised probation in this context in the medical field.
I guess what I'm uncomfortable with is, as Judge Evans has pointed out, there are a number of issues that you're now raising here on appeal that the district court did not have an opportunity to rule on and that you didn't argue in the case below. Why should we reach those questions here?
Your Honor, it was raised below. It was raised in the motion for summary judgment. As a matter of fact, the district court found that that was an issue of fact that had to be determined by the jury.
Right, but they were raised as fact issues. They were raised as fact issues. And so then the question for us is the evidence sufficient enough to support it?
Your Honor, I agree with that latter statement that the what we're asking you to do is decide whether or not there was sufficient evidence to support it, and we argue that there is not, that there is no evidence or insufficient evidence to argue that this is a material adverse employment action as a matter of law, again, giving the plaintiff his inferences, because here what we have is a decision to put him on supervised probation in a medical setting where they're trying to decide whether or not his conduct would be unsafe to people that he was treating.
But, see, I agree with Judge Evans that this case boiled down to whether or not there was discrimination that occurred. I mean, that's what really went to trial. But be that as it may, one of my questions is why wasn't it sufficient evidence for the jury to find that race motivated the decision to place him on probation for 3 months? Behrman acknowledged there had been inconsistency in the way diabetic calls had been handled. There was evidence from other paramedics that they didn't follow this procedure, and Thompson was the only one disciplined.
I'll be happy to address that, Your Honor. First of all, with respect to how this situation was handled with other paramedics, the only evidence in this record was from Tim Brumley, who said to Paula Behrman that there were two individuals after this incident occurred that he became aware of or said to him, well, I never called medical control when I handled a situation like that. There was no evidence as to when that was. In fact, Dr. Doolittle, in his testimony, is the only one who gave any evidence as to time, and he said that how am I going to discipline someone that was involved in a situation 2.5 years ago? There was no evidence in this record with respect to disparate treatment that any of those incidents occurred while Dr. Doolittle was a medical director. As a matter of fact, I believe the case law has said that you have to have comparability of the circumstances before you can get to a disparate treatment. And here you're talking about someone who may have done something 2.5 years ago where you don't know the circumstances. It came to the attention of Dr. Doolittle, and Dr. Doolittle said in his testimony that the reason I put him on probation and I didn't suspend him is because I understood that there had been some inconsistent application. But the reason he put him on probation was because he believed this presented a serious medical issue when you're in an advanced life support protocol involving a diabetic and you don't call the doctor whose medical license you are operating under and determine whether or not you should abide by the patient's decision to refuse treatment. Dr. Doolittle believed that that was a serious situation. And then there's the other issue, which I'll raise because it obviously was an issue that was presented to the jury, is whether or not Dr. Doolittle was the decision maker. Plaintiff argued at trial that Paula Behrman, who was the operations manager, was in fact the functional decision maker. And I would argue that there's no evidence to support that for several reasons. Number one, although she may have made some racially insensitive remarks several years earlier, I think the latest one, according to plaintiff's testimony, was 2001, several years before the decision was made, there's no evidence here that her recommendation was a mere pretext. She said it was a serious protocol that was violated. She was unaware until she was told by Tim Brumley that anyone else had done it before. That's what the evidence is. That doesn't present a similar circumstance. And then also, she recommended that the plaintiff be suspended. And Dr. Doolittle overrode her recommendation on the basis of an independent investigation of five different people, including the written report of Tim Brumley, and he determined that probation was the more appropriate course of action in light of the fact there had been inconsistent application. So there's no evidence of disparate treatment during his watch. There's no evidence that she was aware of it, even if she was the functional decision maker, which we say she was not because her recommendation was not followed. There's absolutely no evidence in this record, none whatsoever, that Dr. Doolittle had any racial animus towards this plaintiff. And finally, and I want to address just one more issue, and that is with respect to the remitter that we've raised. If you read the testimony of Ms. Herzog, who is the medical person that the plaintiff saw, most of what he complains about is a hostile environment with his co-workers. And then secondly, his exposure to blood during a call after the decision to put him on probation, and then third, the probation. And we would argue that based upon that evidence, his testimony, her testimony, that report for the six-week period that he was being seen, that a verdict of $500,000 is monstrously excessive.
That very well might be, and the damages here do not seem to be so severe that that would be supportable. But you never asked the jury or suggested a figure to the jury,
right,
as I understand it. And, you know, that's sort of a decision you make during the trial. And if you don't tell the jury that, for instance, you know, even assuming everything he says, $40,000 or $50,000 ought to be enough, you don't say anything, the other side suggests a big number, and it comes back with a big number. Aren't you kind of stuck with that?
Your Honor, there still has to be evidence to support it. And
so why wasn't any argument made by the defense here as to a damage figure?
I wasn't trial counsel, but I can assume that they were focusing strictly on the liability aspect, and therefore they didn't believe that there was any liability shown. But there still has to be
evidence.
I know,
but that's a chance you take when you say to the jury, look, we win this case on liability. There was no discrimination at all here. Isn't it safe then? Aren't you safer then to say, but even if we were to lose, it should be a 1-0 game, not the 48-0.
That may be the safest course, Your Honor. It wasn't taken here, but all I can say is there still has to be evidence to support it, and I think the Webb case and other cases that have come down from this court have said that they look to see whether or not this is comparable to other verdicts that are being rendered where there's been alleged emotional distress, and we would argue that this is outside of that range, and I'd reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Montgomery.
Thank you and good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, my name is James Montgomery, Jr., and along with Marion Cruz, we represent Archie Thompson in this case.
Are there three lawyers that are going to argue this?
Two lawyers, Your Honor. We will argue the appellee's portion, and then Marion Cruz will argue the appellant's portion of our brief, of our combined brief. Okay. I'd like to first address the issue of waiver. Waiver was not just with respect to the Section 1981 contract, but it was indeed with respect to the material adverse employment action and whether Mr. Thompson met his employer's legitimate employment expectations. The argument that the denied motion to dismiss preserves the waiver is without any support in the case law. Counsel made the argument that the Labor's pension fund case allows the court to fill in the gaps when it has filed a motion for summary judgment as well as the denied 12B6 motion. But as I believe the judges pointed out, first with respect to the 12B6 motion, it went to the sufficiency of the pleadings. We are dealing now with an issue of sufficiency of proof at trial. Likewise, with respect to the summary judgment motion, I believe Judge Kaney referred to that properly. The defendant claimed there was no issue there, or suggested no issue there. But more importantly, laborers doesn't stand for the fact that those motions can fill in the gaps. Laborers says that in the event the trial judge preempts or prevents a party from making an argument completing their argument, that then in all fairness to that party, they won't be penalized, and the court will allow them to look back to earlier pleadings.
You know, I'm going to get to what I think is the most interesting issue, or the critical issue in this
sure.
case, is $500,000 in damages seems mighty high for what happened here. He wasn't fired. He was sad, and he said he cried a little bit, sort of thing. But it just seems like a lot of money.
Well, obviously, Your Honor, and I know you know this, the how the courts review these decisions is driven by the principles of Farfaris and its progeny. And, of course, it was the jury who heard the evidence. What the jury heard was evidence of 45 pages of psychological testimony by Laura Herzog. And in that 45, I mean, that 45 pages of testimony sets this case apart from any case raised by the defendants, by MHC in their briefs, and any case that we raised around the country where there were likewise verdicts in excess of $500,000. That evidence alone sets this case apart, and the jury was impacted by it. Counsel
has Mr. Thompson's salary, or how much did he earn a year at this job?
I believe it was approximately $50,000, Your Honor.
Oh, so this is 10 years of salary as damages?
Yeah, but the compensation is measured by the emotional damage to him, not by how much money he would earn in the workplace. And very, very clearly, the jury felt, defense counsel not suggest a number, but plaintiff's counsel did not suggest a number in argument. This is what the jury listened to. This is what the jury heard. And Farfaris says that we should pay deference to those decisions when obviously they're not monstrous or out of line with other awards. And as we looked around the country, there are plenty of other emotional damage awards that don't have the support of testimony either of the plaintiff or the 45 pages of psychological testimony that we had here.
Well, she said that she rated him as a 4 on a scale of 1 to 4 in terms of severe stress, and he stopped going to those sessions even though the prognosis was excellent because he couldn't afford future sessions. Is that correct?
That's exactly right, and that's further supportive of the proposition that he was not in good shape. He was in pretty bad shape through this entire process. He couldn't continue going to these sessions because once his doctor took him off of work, he was no longer able to afford those sessions. So he never completed them, even though her December prognosis was that if he continued through the paces, then by February he would be in good shape. Now, I would also like to respond to one of the things that counsel had indicated about Laura Herzog's testimony. Her testimony did not go to the hostile environment claim. When she was asked about that at trial, she said, her note regarding hostile environment really referred to the incident during the probation when Thompson felt discriminated against because he was unnecessarily exposed to blood. And another note they pointed out was where she had a note about interpersonal conflicts with coworkers. She pointed out at trial that coworkers was meant loosely, meaning it did include supervisors. MHC has also suggested that damages should be limited to the probation decision and not the events after probation, but Thompson would maintain that it wasn't just the probation decision, but it was the terms, the execution, and the management of that probation which caused him injury, and there is a rational connection and nexus for the compensable injury. I'd like to, since there was some addressing of what we consider the waived issue of material adverse employment action, I'd like to kind of address it because this was not just your run-of-the-mill probation. This was a situation where Thompson was under very specific constraints when he was placed on probation. His supervisors, Paula Bierman and his director, Dottie Miles, even testified that this was strict disciplinary action. That sets this case apart from the Nichols case that was cited by MHC. Nichols was not disciplinary action. He got a medical, in this case it was psychological checkup. He checked out fine and he came back to his job. This case is a case about whether a man was performing his duties properly and the constraints that were placed upon him during the probation. In addition, supervisors were required to accompany him on all runs. He was reduced, we say effectively demoted, but he was reduced from a primary paramedic through this process to a probational paramedic, and that's through Paula Bierman's testimony at page 80 in the record. He was not qualified for promotions during this period. And at the end of the day, and this is true probably for all probations, he faced the risk of losing his job at the conclusion of the probation. In this case, receiving no feedback from his supervisors or the promised feedback from Dr. Doolittle. So this is not just the run-of-the-mill case of probation. This is a very specific probation where there was specific harm and consequences to Mr. Thompson. With respect to the issue of the functional decision-maker doctrine that's found in Maroof v. Walker, it was very clear from the record and the testimony that Paula Bierman lied to Dr. Doolittle about whether Aaron Glenn was in fact had violated the same protocol. She also withheld information about run sheets when Dr. Doolittle asked her to investigate it. She withheld that information. And under Maroof v. Walker, that case says then it doesn't matter whether Dr. Doolittle attempted to perform an investigation if he doesn't have that information, and her discriminatory motive is imputed to him, and she becomes the functional decision maker. As such, she and Tim Brumley, who were both supervisors for Thompson and supervisors for Aaron Glenn, the white employee who also violated the protocol, those two learned, just after they learned of Thompson's protocol, that in fact Aaron Glenn had violated the same protocol. They were considering it at the very same time. It doesn't matter if it happened a week ago, a month ago, or the suggestion of 2.5 years ago, even though it wasn't the evidence that it happened 2.5 years ago. It matters that they were considering it at the very same time, and they swept Aaron Glenn's under the rug, and we know what they did with Thompson. And so we do believe there was disparate treatment. We do believe these two individuals were similarly situated.
You want to save any time for Ms. Cruz?
I think I'll do that. Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, my name is Marion Cruz, and I will now address Archie Thompson's cross appeal. First, the trial court erred when it granted summary judgment in favor of MHC and ambulance service as to Thompson's hostile work environment claim. The trial court erred because it found that Thompson did not present evidence of a hellish workplace, but a hellish workplace is not a threshold requirement for a hostile work environment claim. This court recently held in Jackson versus County of Racine that counsel should not use the overwrought word hellish to describe a workplace under a Title VII claim for hostile work environment.
But do you think you'd be entitled to any more damages than you already got here?
Well, Your Honor, I think that if we were, if the trial court's ruling on summary judgment was reversed and this case was remanded back to the trial court level, that if the hostile work environment claim rose to the level of a constructive discharge claim, that there would potentially be damages for back pay. Does that answer your question sufficiently? Thank you, Your Honor.
We're going to send it back, but maybe it should be sent back on everything.
And that's a ruling that you will be making. In terms of the focus that the Jackson court found to be important, it's rather not what a hellish environment is or is not, but whether a protected group received racial harassment in the workplace due to their protected characteristic, and whether or not it was detrimental to their workplace advancement and performance. At the summary judgment phase, Thompson presented sufficient evidence such that there was a genuine issue of material fact as to these issues. First, looking to the conduct of MHC, Paula Bierman was supervisor to Thompson and controlled his employment status. She, from the very beginning, made statements to Thompson that demonstrated her racial animus, the first being that she told Thompson, even before he had been promoted to be a paramedic, that he couldn't do what others could do because he was black. Thompson submits that this is particularly severe because coming in as an employee, a supervisor telling him he can't do what he was hired to and is being trained to do by a supervisor, and that she would be watching for his failure, creates a hostile environment from the very beginning. And it turns out that Bierman's statements were correct because Thompson was placed on probation by MHC for an alleged violation of a protocol that other paramedics who were white had violated and did so without repercussion. Also, Thompson presented his complaints of racial harassment to Paula Bierman and other supervisors, and they were ignored, dismissed, put off. And in one particularly egregious situation, Bierman even taunted his claims, saying, "Don't stand too close to me, else I will file my own female discrimination suit against you." Thompson also suffered hostile work environment conditions at the hands of ambulance service employees. Ambulance service says that there's only 2 to 3 incidents that were isolated showing racial harassment at the workplace. To this, I urge the court to consider its decision in Saros, which states, "While there's no magic number of slurs that indicate a hostile work environment, we have recognized before that an unambiguously racial epithet falls on the more severe end of the spectrum." Rogers also finds that while perhaps no single act can more quickly alter the conditions of employment and create an abusive working environment than the use of an unambiguously racial epithet such as the word nigger by a supervisor in the presence of his subordinates. There was evidence at the summary judgment phase that Gerald Lentz, supervisor to Thompson, did just that in front of subordinates. He was watching news in the break room, referred to blacks using that racial slur, and he said that he wasn't surprised that blacks were involved in this crime. Lentz also made a direct comment to Thompson when he was looking at a jar of black beans and told him this is what his children would look like. There's other incidents of racial harassment made by other employees, such as Gary Bartlow, who also used racial slurs, including the word nigger and coon, in front of Gerald Lentz, who was a supervisor, who did nothing to remedy the conduct and nothing to correct the conduct, and presumably that's because he was engaging in the same behavior. Other incidents include the graffiti that Thompson viewed on the picnic table outside the Carbondale base stating KKK, and the incident where Larry Jolly threatened and intimidated him and dared him to call him a racist. Therefore, as to the first issue, we respectfully request that this court reverse the trial court's ruling as to the summary judgment motion in favor of MHC and ambulance service as to the hostile work environment claim. Thompson also suffered a constructive discharge at the hands of both MHC and ambulance service because he was put on probation and placed from a primary paramedic to probational paramedic, and that was a decrease in responsibility that was sufficient that a reasonable person would be forced to resign. Also, in the briefs and established at the summary judgment phase was that the probation that Thompson was placed on by MHC and was executed by ambulance service employees included conditions that were intolerable and which Thompson endured for 2 months before effectively resigning or taking medical leave. He was subjected to unnecessary risks of safety risks, and health risks, as well as the general public, as well as his patients. This distinguishes his case from those cited by MHC and ambulance service, including the Ulickney case, where the plaintiff had a restructuring of her duties by her employer. Her employer asked her to take part in that restructuring, and she declined, and then she resigned 2 weeks later. They also cite Gruby, wherein the plaintiff was transferred to another shift, and that plaintiff resigned 20 minutes later. Here, the evidence was sufficient such that Thompson endured these intolerable work conditions for 2 months. He sought professional help. He took leave. It was intolerable for him, but he remained employed in that position. And therefore, we submit that Thompson did present evidence at the summary judgment phase sufficient to show there was a genuine issue of material fact, especially when we take the facts most favorable to the plaintiff, in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And we did meet that higher constructive discharge burden. Based on the foregoing, Thompson asks that we that this court reverse both rulings that the trial court made as to the summary judgment motions in favor of MHC and ambulance service.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Craig Unrath, and I represent Jacksonville Ambulance Service. I am the fourth and I believe the last individual you'll be seeing other than Mr. Eden, who will have rebuttal. Counsel made a good point. Throughout my brief and Judge Murphy's opinion granting summary judgment in favor of the ambulance service, he referred to the hellish environment. I agree personally with this court's decision to have that description removed from litigation on this issue. It is hyperbole. It is taking things too far. But then I look at the facts of this case, and I see the claims of intolerable conditions, unbearable conditions. In a sense, the counsel is setting this up to believe it was hellish. Perhaps we just have different standards. Now, the reason that the district court granted summary judgment is actually fairly simple. It can be boiled down to a simple premise. Relatively isolated and innocuous incidents will not support a claim for a hostile environment. Now, out of all the claims of harassment and disciplinary measures, one has to look at this and determine how much of this could the Jackson Ambulance Service be responsible for. How much of that conduct could we do anything about? We are cast in the role as dual employers, but one thing is clear. We work for the emergency medical system. We work for Dr. Doolittle. We work for the system coordinator, Paula Bierman. Our ambulances do not leave the road, do not leave the garage without their supervision and their approval. We work under their medical license. They supervise every aspect of our work. They decide the qualifications that our EMTs must meet, and then they determine whether those qualifications have been met. We can't even promote an EMT without the approval of the EMS. As a matter of fact, we simply can't do it. It's either the EMS promotes them or they do not get promoted. And the same is true with disciplinary actions. The Jackson Ambulance Service simply does not engage in taking any disciplinary action at all. They don't define the terms of that disciplinary action, nor do they define whether it should even occur. So what we're left with is a small group of incidents that Jacksonville Ambulance can be said to have, could be said to have been within our control. Let's take a quick look at what we have here. The very first incident occurred soon after Thompson started his employment. In October of 1996, somebody carved KKK on a picnic table outside of a break area. The EMT who carved those initials apologized to Thompson personally. Thompson received a letter of apology from Jackson Ambulance, and in Thompson's own words, he said, they took care of it. Okay, now that was October 1996. What's the next incident? Well, we have to wait 4 more years for anything to come up. In 2000, sometime in 2000, a supervisor, Lentz, used the N-word and allowed another supervisor to do the same thing. And yet, it is an established principle of law that racial comments made outside the employee's presence do not support a claim for hostile environment. So what else do we have? We have, at some other undetermined date, Gerald Lentz compared a jar of black beans to Thompson's children, which I suppose one could take this as a racial insult. Personally, I look at it as an indication of Gerald Lentz's intelligence, which was apparently not very high. Next incident. This is actually fairly important. In 2002, Thompson was transferred from the Ava facility to Murfreesboro. Now, this is an important transfer because at Ava, pretty much all he did was transfer patients from one hospital to another. Here at Murfreesboro, now he has a chance to work on the streets, real emergencies. He arrives. The first thing they do is assign him a transfer job. And he looks over and he sees another crew right there, a transfer crew. And he says, why not them? I have seniority here. And then he says this. He goes, what is this? Just a good old boys network? Now, I look at that and I see Thompson injecting race into this situation. Certainly none of the supervisors or other employees raised that issue. And the following day, this supervisor confronted him with that. He said, are you claiming I'm a racist? I dare you to tell me I'm a racist. That was the end of it. The apology was made. Again, I don't see that anyone at Jacksonville injected race into the situation. I do see that Thompson did. That's it. We're done. Now we're on to the probationary period. There were two incidents. One, there was a bleeding homeless man. Lentz, who was instructed not by Jackson Ambulance, but by Dr. Doolittle. Dr. Doolittle said, do not help him, do not assist him. And apparently, Lentz did just that. He said, deal with it on your own, and prevented other paramedics from helping him. Perhaps that was a good thing. Maybe it's a good thing to find out if a paramedic can handle these situations. In the future, he will be on his own. Mr. Thompson claims that he was exposed to potentially HIV-infected blood. Of course, we have no evidence of that. But I guess the bottom line is that there's no particular racial component to that. This is what Lentz was told to do, instructed to do, by Dr. Doolittle. The next one is a broken leg, an incident where Thompson believed that the supervisors were providing too much help. So we have a situation here where the Lentz is either providing not enough help, or when he does help, he's providing too much. In either case, he said Thompson, you know, that this inflicted unnecessary pain on the patient, and he could have been held responsible for that. Fact is, he was not held responsible. To the contrary, all reports are that his probationary period was going along beautifully. There were no complaints of any problems at all. Now, this court has a very difficult task. It must find a middle path between finding that any offensive conduct is actionable, and require and the opposite extreme, which would be requiring that the plaintiff be the victim of psychological injury due to the conditions of his environment. You are looking for a middle path, and quite frankly, Your Honor, I see this one as not even close to the extreme. This is not a hostile environment. I don't believe that any rational jury could have found so. And on that basis, we ask that this court uphold the district court's order granting summary judgment in our favor.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you very much.
Mr.
May I ask how much time, sir? 7 minutes, thank you. In this part of the argument, I'm wearing two hats, one as cross-appellee and second my rebuttal on the main appeal. And I'd like to begin, first of all, with my rebuttal. First of all, with respect to the issue of waiver, in the post-judgment motion, the 50B motion, this issue was directly fronted with Judge Murphy. In our post-judgment motion, we raised the issue, plaintiff failed to establish that he had a basis for a claim under Section 1981. We cite to Judge Foreman's denial of that motion, where he said, upon review of the pleadings, factual development is needed to determine whether plaintiff had a contract of employment. Plaintiff was clearly on notice that that was his burden during trial, and as a matter of fact, plaintiff asked questions of Ms. Bierman, of Dr. Doolittle, what is the situation with the emergency medical system, the Jackson County Ambulance Service, who reports to who controls what. Plaintiff was trying to meet his burden, and we raised this issue specifically with Judge Murphy post-trial. Plaintiff didn't meet the burden of proving factually that he had a contract, and so it was raised in the 50B, and plaintiff was certainly on notice with our motion to dismiss. With respect to whether he suffered a material adverse employment action, again, Judge Murphy found, when he denied the motion for summary judgment, that that was a fact issue and the plaintiff could go forward on trial. There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that plaintiff was on notice that that was his burden, because during the trial, plaintiff tried to expand the whole notion of the decision to put him on probation to the post-probationary situation where he claims that he was materially hurt in his employment situation. He tried to make a case. He failed, in our opinion. Judge Murphy was given that issue in the 50B, and Judge Murphy denied it. So it was raised at the trial court several different times, and the judge denied it, and we believe we preserved that issue for appeal. And as a matter of law, we believe that the plaintiff had insufficient evidence or no evidence to demonstrate that there was a materially adverse economic condition involved here or action, or that he had a contract under 1981. Let me address also a very important issue raised by Mr. Montgomery, and that is this issue of Paula Bierman's alleged bias and what her role was in the decision. What we do know is that Dr. Doolittle was involved in establishing the protocol, because that was his responsibility as medical director. We know, and they pointed Paula Bierman's testimony, that she did not inform him of any other names that she became aware of who had violated that protocol, although she did testify that it had been inconsistently applied, and Dr. Doolittle was aware of that. And Dr. Doolittle, in his investigation of others, his independent investigation, determined that it had been inconsistently applied, and therefore he gave him probation as opposed to suspension. And I believe it's very relevant as to when this other conduct occurred in the issue of proving intentional discrimination based upon disparate treatment, because if you're going to impose a punishment or discipline on someone who did something 2.5 years ago and say you shouldn't have done it that way, that is materially different than a situation of something that had just occurred. Number one, it wasn't the same decision maker then. It was another medical director, because Dr. Doolittle had only been there since April 2003. We don't know what the other medical director was aware of or not aware of. We don't know whether Ms. Bierman was aware of that at that time. There was no evidence. And it seems to me, when we're talking about burdens, that it was the plaintiff's burden, if he wanted to prove that they treated Aaron Glenn differently, he should have put on evidence from Mr. Glenn or someone else as to when that occurred. Brumley was asked. He didn't know the timing. He didn't know the timing of the other event. So in order to prove intentional discrimination based on disparate treatment, there has to be evidence as to when it occurred, what were the circumstances, why are they similar to Archie Thompson's circumstances, and that was not proved. And again, there was absolutely no evidence of racial animus by Dr. Doolittle. And even if Paula Bierman had racial animus, even if the jury believed that, What she failed to tell him, according to the plaintiff, was that there had been other instances where this occurred. The doctor found out about that independent of whether she told him or not by doing an independent investigation. So that is irrelevant. Her biases didn't spill over into the decision because, number one, he found out from others what happened. Number two, he didn't follow her advice. So the medical doctor whose license Mr. Thompson was operating under made this decision based upon the safety of patients. And that was the decision that went to the jury as to whether or not there was intentional discrimination, not what happened afterwards, not what happened while he was on probation. And if you review that testimony, essentially it's Mr. Thompson's disagreement with his supervisors as to how certain patients were treated. Those were medical decisions that the supervisors, Dr. Doolittle, had to handle. And finally, with respect to the cross-appeal, it requires, as this court is well aware, on hostile environment, severe and pervasive conduct, and I would agree with Mr. Unrath's arguments. The only things they could point to as to Paula Bierman occurred in 1998, again in 2001. Archie Thompson stayed during that entire period up to 2003. And we believe that has no relevance with respect to the issue of the cross-appeal. And the only employees of the Memorial Hospital or the emergency medical system were Dr. Doolittle and Ms. Bierman. And everything that Mr. Thompson points to were supervisors that were employed by the Jackson County Ambulance Service. Although I'm not suggesting for a minute that they created a hostile work environment, it was not our people that was involved in the situation in the post-probation. For those reasons, we would ask that you reverse the decision of the jury based upon no evidence to show intentional discrimination, and that you also deny the cross-appeal and affirm the lower court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eaton. Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.